Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me or Fedora, Debian, BSD, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First one in the list, we ended in the previous episode with iBus. First one in the list this time is iceauth. Yeah, it's iceauth. iceauth is a system that X11, the graphical server of Linux and BSD, uses for inter-client exchange. In fact, that's what ICE stands for, ICE, inter-client exchange. The documentation on this is not terribly long, to be honest. They've got an overview of ICE, which describes ICE as inter-client protocols with many similarities and common needs, including authentication, version negotiation, byte order negotiation, and more. So the ICE protocol provides a framework for building protocols so that you can have one X11 server talk to another. So in other words, you could have, for instance, a media player, a music player on one client, and when the song changes, or maybe there's a new song available, then it updates the other client and alerts it that there's new content available or something like that. I mean, obviously the sky's the limit. This is designed to create protocols that, you know, to enable applications to talk to one another. So this is the library set and the headers and stuff that people would use to design those applications. You might find in some cases a ICE authority file in your home directory. I mean, I've got an ICE authority file. It's empty, but it is there. And the idea would be in a use case where ICE was some kind of ICE protocol is being used by an application, the ICE authority file would receive some kind of magic cookie. That means, like, you know, a string of letters and numbers. And then the other side, the other client that your application is speaking to, would also have an ICE authority file, and it would have a magic cookie. And if those two magic cookies are the same, if someone hashes them or something, whatever the scenario, if they match in some way by whatever requirement is there, then the two clients can talk to each other. The iceauth command, which this package contains, iceauth, we'll see libice later or something like that. I think it's libice. But the iceauth command and the man page, and I think that might be about it in this package, is a command for sort of interactive ICE introspection. So you can use the iceauth application to list all the entries in your ICE authority file, if any. I'll do iceauth space list, iceauth creating new authorization file. Okay, that's interesting because I already had one, I thought, but that's fine. iceauth creating, oh, it just does that every time, I guess, when it's empty, I'm assuming, because it just keeps saying that it's creating a new file, and it's the same file. How about iceauth info? There we go. Authority file, run user, my ID, ICE authority. File new, yes. File locked, yes. Number of entries, zero. Changes honored, yes. Changes made, no. Current input, argv1. So that's the info for my ICE authority file, such as it is. But with iceauth, you can manually add an entry into your authority file. You do iceauth add, and then the protocol name, and then the protocol data, a net ID, auth name, auth data. If you don't have any reason to add something, like if you're not trying to contact another client or see why you can't contact that client or something, I don't see why you would do this manually, but you could do this. You can use this in a shell script, this command, and you can utilize the iceauth system to, I don't know what you would want to do, But that's a method that you could feasibly utilize. I was trying to look for a sort of a simple ICE use case, and I really could not find one. So I'm not feeling like ICE is super common right now. I could be wrong, but I was struggling to find use cases or examples. And specifically, I was wondering if there was a shell script out there that actually did put ICE auth to good use. And I, again, could not really find one. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means I was unsuccessful in finding sort of that snapshot of here's ICE auth being used for something practical in an everyday setting. So not really sure how often it's utilized. I think probably, again, my kind of go-to example is where you're in a production house of some sort. I mean, I'm thinking media because that's my background, but you're in a production house or whatever you call a business that's not a production house, like a business that has like, or an organization that has a bunch of Unix boxes or Linux boxes. And for whatever reason, you know, maybe you have roaming workers, you know, who aren't assigned to certain desks, or maybe you've got a certain set of workstations that are assigned to a specific task. Maybe ICE auth could be used to trigger a job on some remote system. But I mean, honestly, again, I'm not 100% sure why that would be ICE auth instead of just, I don't know, SSH or something. So I don't have a good picture of how common ICE auth really, really is. And I couldn't find a whole lot about it, which kind of makes me think it's not super common, but I could be wrong. Could be hidden away in all kinds of things. So that's something to ponder, I guess. And if you're a Shadowrun player or reader, if you're thinking about intrusion countermeasure electronics, then so did I. That was exactly what I was thinking, but nothing having to do with that really. Okay, that was a lot about ICE auth, something that I don't actually know that much about. So let's move on quickly. ICO. ICO is the next one. Icosahedrons is what this program draws. So it's ICO, ICO, because I bet icosahedron is probably too complex for a command name. I would say so. But ICO, yeah, it animates wireframe icosahedrons or other polyhedrons. You can actually define what shape geometric shape you want to display. An icosahedron is a 20-sided polyhedron, but as I say, you can choose others like pyramid. There's a list somewhere. I just remember pyramid. There are a couple. Icosahedron is the default. Pyramid is another. I know there are others. Here we go. No. It is listed somewhere in the man page. I'm just not seeing it as I quickly, frantically scan for a list of shapes. It might have been, you know what it might be? Actually, --help. Ico --help. And then faces. Draw faces. No, that wasn't it. List polyhedral objects available. That's it. --obj help. So I'm going to do --ico-obj help, and that tells me that I can draw a cube, an icosahedron, octahedron, a pyramid, or a plane. And it tells you how many sides that has and how many lines it's going to require and so on. And that's what it does. So if you do like ico-obj, pyramid, then and press return, then a new window appears with a bunch of dancing pyramids. Like just, I guess, as many pyramids as it can draw per second or something, you know? I mean, it's so fast. So you can do a couple of other things to maybe influence what you're seeing, like --lw is a line width of 3. So now you're seeing thicker pyramids in this case. Q closes the window of icosahedron or polyhedrons in this case. So, you can just click the X, you know, the normal window closing, window decoration button too, but Q does quit it as well. Okay. So, you can also do a --sleep, and I don't, what's the range in sleep? I think it's like from 0 to 1, or am I making that up? I'm going to just try 0.5 and see what happens. Oh, it's so slow, but there it is. I mean, that's not bad. And that just draws the one pyramid for some reason floating through space. It looks like, if you've ever seen the, you know, sort of the early version, like way early version of, Asteroids. It kind of looks like that a little bit. It's just kind of like white lines on a black screen, and this particular pyramid is just kind of bouncing off the edges of the terminal. It's kind of silly. You can do dash colors. Well, I think you have to do dash faces to tell it to draw the faces, and then dash colors to color, you know, to shade the faces, essentially. Yeah, there we go. So I just did dash faces and then dash colors, plural, and then something like red, or you could probably do green, I imagine. Yeah, it's kind of cool. So, and I don't know why I'm sticking with a pyramid. I could do lots of different things. Like, I could just leave it at the default and just get a icosahedron. There's a what looks like a 20-sided die to me, just rolling on my desktop. That's pretty cool. So what's the use of this, really? I have not been super successful in, okay, 0.25 is a little bit better, or, you know, a little bit more interesting, I guess. .1 is even better. Like, that's kind of nice. Okay, anyway, so what's the point? I mean, I think it's kind of like, oh man, what was that? What's that benchmarking program that everyone used? Gears? X-Gears or something like that? Gears, maybe. Maybe it's just Gears. Yeah, it's just Gears. Gears does like an OpenGL, I think it's OpenGL, render of moving gears. And people used to use that a lot just to kind of see, okay, well, how good is this computer that I'm about to purchase? And you could make the window, you know, full screen and see if the gears are still spinning or if they have to slow down. You know, you're kind of testing the frame rate. So I think probably that's what Ico was intended as well. In the modern day and age, I mean, I have to slow it down to so that it doesn't look like just kind of random line, like blips on my screen. But that's probably more or less what it's intended for. It's probably kind of a benchmarking test. So I've just made the window full screen, and I mean it's only drawing the one, so I guess that's not that much of a test of my system. But I mean I don't doubt that my system could draw lots of icosahedrons without a problem at this quality. I think I'm not too worried about that. So that is Ico. I have a feeling it's probably, like I say, for benchmarking, maybe testing to make sure that, you know, like graphic things are working as intended. Let's talk about IGT GPU tools. I can't say a whole lot about this one because I don't have an Intel graphics chip in this computer. This is an AMD machine. I'm happy to use the Intel graphics cards. I don't care that much about what's generating an image on my screen, but this just happens to be an AMD box. So I don't get the i915 thing. I don't get all of the Intel components, I don't have them. So this IGT, which stands for Intel GPU Tools, I think, or maybe Intel Graphics Tools, I don't know. I think it's Intel GPU Tools, interestingly. So it's like IGT, Intel GPU Tools, -GPU Tools. And this package contains binaries such as i915 perf configs, i915 perf control, Intel Gen 4 ASM, Intel audio dump, Intel backlight, Intel BIOS dumper, you know, just stuff that literally none of this would apply to me on this system. So those are the GPU tools. Here's what the package itself has sort of to say about itself. Where did it go? Here it is. IGT GPU tools is a collection of DRM driver tools that include low-level tools and tests for development and testing of DRM drivers. So in order to understand what that is, we do have to understand what DRM is. And DRM is, I mean, you can even do just a man DRM on your system. This is not what you think it is. If you're thinking about like, digital restrictions management, that's not what this is. This is a different DRM, something that's fine. It's a good DRM, not like the other DRM. This DRM stands for Direct Rendering Manager. That's if you do, again, man DRM in your terminal, you'll get a pretty good like rundown of what this does. And what it does is it manages graphic processing units, or GPU. So it used to be, I guess, that the kernel framework was just, it just gave you hardware access to the thing that set the pixels on or off, you know, and you could just draw on the screen just by sending, I guess, bits to the whatever they were called then. What were they called? Video cards, I guess? I don't know. Yeah, I guess they were video cards, right? I mean, that's probably, is that a GPU? I don't know. I don't know what things used to be like, but because I didn't know computers then. I should know. I wasn't into computers, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. I'm just not up on that kind of old technology, or, you know, former technology. I don't mean old, but I mean, it is old, I guess, from one perspective. But yeah, so however you used to do it, that's not how they do it now. They assume that you've got a graphics processing unit of some kind, even if that's just something embedded somewhere on a chip, a shared memory or something. But they assume that you're going to have to manage that. So as you probably know, when there's hardware on the within the, you know, physical computer, and then there's software, the two typically need to talk to each other somehow. You need some kind of intermediary driver to communicate between what the hardware sort of like knows, and by knowing, I mean it's got a certain set of instructions that it can accept and a certain number of tasks that it can do. The software needs to know what kind of instructions to send this hardware and what to expect out of the hardware. Now, because there are lots of different GPUs out there in the world, you know, we've got a couple of different major brands like Intel and AMD and Nvidia, but there are lots of varieties within even those brands. And then I'm sure I'm not even thinking of some of the other brands out there that also have to display graphics. So you need a driver. The driver is, or the DRM, the Direct Rendering Manager, that's the thing that you leverage to have a driver speaking with from the hardware to the software and vice versa. That's DRM. So in the overall stack, it is, it's between like OpenGL, drawing all the pretty pictures on your screen, or rather an application exists. The application is using OpenGL or Vulkan or whatever. And then that Vulkan library is linked to libDRM. LibDRM is the thing creating the interface between, you know, it's calling up that driver, and because the driver exists, it knows about the hardware, and therefore DRM can speak to the hardware. So I guess in almost DRM is, I hesitate to say it's like a software representation of the graphics card, but it kind of is. It's kind of your target. You know, not even directly, you're probably just, your target is probably just an OpenGL or a Vulkan library. But ultimately, what's being done is that your requests for a sphere that is reflecting a checkerboard tile floor, that your request to draw that onto the user's screen is actually being filtered through your Direct Rendering Manager libraries. And if you are working within that system, if you're trying to develop a new driver or modify a driver, you might want to use IGT GPU tools to help you understand what kind of hardware you have, what it's capable of, what it's compliant with, and so on. Next package is iMake, which I spent a little time trying to wrap my head around, or rather trying to get to work. I mean, I was able to wrap my head around it pretty quickly, but getting it to actually work required a little bit more effort. And in the end, I kind of gave up on it because, quote, the X Window system used, past tense, iMake extensively up through X11R 6.9 for both full builds within the source tree and external software. X moved to GNU AutoConf and AutoMake for its build system in 2005 for X11R 7.0 and all later releases, but still provides iMake for building existing external software programs that have not yet been converted. So I don't know, 20 years later, I think it's, or 19, I guess, I think it's safe to say that this is not an, I mean, it specifically says it's not, it is not being actively maintained for new operating systems or platform releases. I don't see the relevance here, to be frank. So iMake, what's it supposed to do? It's supposed to generate a make file for you. However, it does appear to require a make file template, which the man page mentions, but there's no mention of what a template file looks like. I couldn't find a template bundled with iMake. I couldn't find the websites. Kitebird.com doesn't seem to exist anymore. It took me to like a football site from some other country that I couldn't read the language of. And another site, I think I never got through to that one, so there don't seem to be any resources for iMake as listed. And in the end, I figured, like I said, I don't think this is worth the time to invest in it. So I would recommend going back to previous episodes of GNU World Order and listening to the stuff about AutoConf and AutoMake and the whole build process, because that's where even X11 has gone now. They've walked away from their own solution, iMake, and are using just GNU Auto Build, or AutoConf, rather. Which makes sense. I think, you know, on the one hand, of course, we all do want the variety. We want the choice of tools that maybe approach problems differently and so on. But then at the same time, there's that there's the conflicting feeling that, yeah, let's just kind of consolidate. Like, so I only have to learn one system and it works. And when I start seeing errors in this thing, then maybe it'll call back to an error that I saw over here. And it just all starts to sort of come together and kind of make sense. So I sympathize with the idea of let's just use the thing that everyone else is using. It's being developed by another group. It's very actively maintained and everyone knows it. And let's just do that. So I think that's what they've done. And I think that was probably a good call. Next up is Intel VAPI driver, VA driver for Intel G45 and HD graphics family. This is the VA API, that's VAPI, VA API implementation. I mean, I'm saying it VAPI, I'm not telling you to say it that way. It's probably VA API implementation for Intel chipsets and the Intel HD graphic chip. And these are technologies you might remember from like 2009. Through maybe 2000 and, well, gee, and you know, so it's the Intel Core processor family. And I'm trying to think, was the I series, like the i5, i7, i3, were those considered the Intel Core processor? Was that part of that line? Or did that end with Intel Core Duo 2? I don't remember. Either way, that's what this is. It's a driver. And we've already kind of talked about the drivers for the GPUs, the chips that draw the pictures. You need that intermediary system that understands everything about that chipset, knows what you're able to ask of it, knows what to expect from it, so that some other library like OpenGL or Vulkan can just make a call to the GPU and you don't have to worry about while you're coding. Nobody has to worry about exactly how to make this request. And that's important because, like, I've definitely used systems whereby you end up, and I'm not saying this doesn't happen, this definitely happens, but I mean, I've definitely used programming languages or frameworks, rather, whereby you end up with this sort of at least three if then else statement clause where you're checking what platform you're on or checking what kind of graphic system is available to you, or because you have to know, because on this one platform with this one set of possibilities, then you have to, I don't know, double buffer your graphics. And on this other one, you don't have to do that, or you can't do that, or it'll start flickering or whatever. So actually, I said that a little bit backwards, but you get the idea. You know, there are options sometimes. And I'm not saying that goes away with this sort of support, but believe me, it's a lot less without that kind of support. You all you do is make standardized calls to a library, and then you let the individual drivers that are specifically designed for some other platform, or rather some, I guess, a framework, you let those worry about the specifics. And that's very, very convenient. All right. So that gets us out of sort of the I section. Now, remember, we're in the X directory. So that's, we're still in the X directory, but it's listed alphabetically. That was the last of the I's. The next section are libs, libraries. We've done a bunch of libraries in the past. They're tough to do because they're all libraries. So as a user, you don't tend to interact with them directly. As a developer, you might, but then if you are, you're probably vaguely aware of what you need, and then you find the libraries to suit your requirement. So these are a bit of a weird one to try to cover. There aren't that many, and I think I can get through them all in 2 or 3 episodes. So most of them start with X. But once we get into the X's, I don't feel like there's going to be a whole lot to say, because as I say, it's just, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, oh, it's a library that makes X11 work. And we'll kind of end it there, or we'll leave it with that. Before we delve into the library, though, let's delve into some coffee. You go get a cup, I'll go get a cup, come back, finish up the show. And we're back. I have my Memphis coffee, which I have blended with the Big Cozy. The Big Cozy is a very mild kind of coffee that Flight Coffee here in New Zealand advertises as a winter blend or something like that. Or maybe, no, Big Cozy, it would have to be winter, which I'm just getting out of at the time of recording. It's technically spring now, although I had the fireplace going just last week. So it's one of those, you know, it's that time of year. So Big Cozy winter blend, very mild. I quite like it. I thought I would try something a little bit different. Memphis, it's quite good as well. And I have to say, it's a little bit on the strong side. And I think I realized that essentially at the end of the day, it's kind of like, well, yes, I like mild coffees, I think, because because it's mild and I can drink it all day happily. Whereas if it's a very, very bold coffee, maybe the heart rate starts to get a little bit too escalated towards the end of the day after I've been drinking like various numbers of pots of coffee. So I'm kind of doing a custom blend, which is not uncommon these days. I've been doing a lot of custom blends, not to say that I do it all the time, or even intentionally half the time. But this time it was intentional. I just thought, you know what? I'm going to cut this in half. And it's been good. It's been really good. I've been really enjoying every cup. So that's where I'm at. That's what I'm having. Let's talk about LibFS. LibFS is the font server library for X11. As we've discussed in the in previous episodes, there is this concept of a font server in X11 that knows all about your fonts. And font config, of course, or what is it, FC? Well, FC, the FC series of commands, is the sort of your direct interface to that font server and to other font servers, possibly. You can run a font server on a remote machine and then access those fonts from a different machine. So it's a typical sort of X kind of concept of, if it's on the network, you can access it through X. I don't think that this is a technology that's going to be maybe necessarily super long for the world. I don't get the sense that there are that many places actually using a font server. I think they should. I think it's a great idea. But let's be honest, did you know that it existed? I didn't until I started looking at all of these, you know, like, I knew about font config for ages, because it's on Slackware, after you install a font for your terminal, I think you're supposed to supposedly run font config. I don't even know if that's necessary anymore. But I mean, that used to be the sort of the thing. It's like, do that after you do this. So I knew about font config for ages, but I never knew that you could literally have fonts over on a remote machine and then use them on your local host. I mean, that's just so cool. It's such a great idea. Can you imagine having a design house where your designers don't all have to have like the same batch of fonts installed on their on their local host all the time. They just make a call out to the font server. That's such a great idea. Although, I mean, these days, I guess, honestly, disk space is cheap. You've got tools like Ansible or Puppet, and you can just say, let's go out to all the machines on the network, make sure they've got all of these fonts installed. If not, install it, and then we're done. So maybe it's not even worth it anymore. But anyway, that's libfs. That's the font server library. And then there's libice, which we just talked about. We talked about ice, the inter-client exchange library. This is the thing that makes iceauth work. Or rather, it's the thing that iceauth, like, you know, interfaces with. And then there's libsm for session management. And I guess we haven't really talked about this yet, interestingly. I mean, we've been in the X directory, and sort of the concept of what an X session is has yet to really come up in conversation. So the session management library of X11, according to the documentation, is a low-level C language interface to XSMP. XSMP is X Session Management Protocol. This is meant to provide a uniform mechanism for users to save and restore an X session. Now, I think, and I could vaguely be wrong about this, but I believe, especially after reading the documentation, and I have several reasons for believing this. I think I'm right, but there could be details here that I'm wrong about. But I think essentially, in general, very, very general, libsm, XSMP has been basically replaced for most of us by some kind of session manager for a desktop. Now, if you are one of the people who you really do just start an X session with, like, StartX, or maybe, I guess it would be StartX, or maybe, I guess you could also do Xinit directly. You could do that. But if you're one of those people who's just running an X session, and then once you've got an X session, you bring up just X applications or something, which I don't believe there are many out there. Now, you might be someone who runs, like, IceWM or TWM, sorry, TWM. Sure, you might do that. But I think, and in that case, libsm may well be a thing that you interact with. But I don't think that most of us are using libsm. And I don't believe that libsm talks directly to things like sddm. In fact, let's just do an ldd on user bin sddm. That wouldn't work. How about sddm.bin? There we go. Okay, there is a lot there. Let's do a grep of -i of libsm. Okay, just to make sure, smlib. No. Yeah, so it sddm, for instance, is not linked to libsm. So all of the things that sddm, which is the session manager for on Slackware for KDE, I don't believe that it's tapping into the abilities of libsm at all. But if you weren't using sddm or any other desktop with a session manager, then you could use libsm in theory, and you could have you could inquire about your session, like, what kind of applications are you running, maybe, and where are the applications located in the window or in the display, maybe. I don't know, I've never used it, so I'm pretending like I understand what a session in X11 is interpreted as, but from the documentation, that does seem like more or less what the idea is. There are several sort of commands that you can run, functions that you can use from within libsm to sort of introspect about the session that is running. And it does tie into things like ice, libice. So, well, I'll get to that in a moment. And it's aware of other things like XFT, or XFT rather is aware of it. It knows if you're shutting something down. It knows if you can save a session. You can retrieve. You can save the session management properties, or retrieve them, or delete them if you're done with a session. Really, so it seems like session management. Like you and I would think of session management on a desktop. And if you don't think about session management, then that means when you shut down your computer at night and you have three different windows open, when you boot your computer back up and open your desktop, if you've selected, yes, restore my session, then those three windows should open up again in the pretty much the exact same place that they used to be. It kind of depends on the application and how aware of it is of the concept of sessions, like how well it integrates. But generally speaking, that's what you get. Now, libsm is the X11 version of that. And one thing about X11 that I'm really kind of getting more and more now that we're sort of just hanging out in the X directory is that the X11 group they're in a weird way, they are just, they're on a different planet. I mean this in the best of ways. And they have been on a different planet. I mean, X11 is so flexible. It is almost, we do it a disservice, I think, by saying, oh, X11 is the thing that is the graphic server for your computer. It is. But it also is so much more. X11 is a network of applications, of server applications. It can serve graphics and applications and fonts and all these kinds of, you know, these network aware technologies that we just, most of us, I think, just really, really underutilize. Now, I'm not saying everyone underutilizes them. I do know for a fact, I have worked at a place where that was leveraged quite a lot, like the ability to launch applications within varying environments and from different remote machines. Like that was a real thing that was happening and happens in certain places. So it does happen, but it requires, you know, super computer kind of setups, or at least true multi-user setups, where you've just got a lot of machines that are each kind of talking to each other and share lots of data from a centralized place to really make it like worth all the trouble. Like otherwise, and I think the way that computing has gone, it's really just kind of like individual nodes or maybe islands, really. You know, you've got your workstation and you've got all your data there, and yeah, maybe you push your backup files somewhere, but I mean, and maybe something logs into your computer and brings it up to date and makes sure it's got everything that it needs. But that's kind of the, you know, each little thing is a satellite on its own. Whereas X11 just saw everything as connected. I mean, it was just, it's phenomenal. But I mean, it is correspondingly complex. I'm not trying to say X11 is so amazing that we should keep it around necessarily, because it is. It's really, really complex. And a lot of these technologies aren't getting used because they're just not easy to make happen. Like you try setting up a network in your house where there's just complete transparency over which computer has a font installed and where an application actually lives, and you launch something remotely and you just don't care what computer it's actually on, and it inherits all of your different themes and it has perfect integration with your remote your roaming home folder. You know, I mean, it is really, really complex. And I think because other technologies have ended up providing basically the same experience through really easier technologies in some cases. I mean, how easy is it to have a backup drive in your home or a cloud account somewhere? I mean, it's really easy. So why would you spend all the time unraveling all of the different settings that you need for X11 to work? Well, I think most of us don't. And that's why it's getting phased out. I think there's a lot of stuff there that in an alternate timeline would have been amazing to experience. And ideally, that would have gotten a lot easier. I mean, I will say, when I started Linux, even when I started relatively, you know, certainly later than others, right? There were people using Linux before I started using it. Even then, X11, configuring your X11 server, or your Zorg.conf, was a nightmare. Like you had to get all of the settings manually, you had to enter them in, and you had to do it right, and you had to think about like vertical sync of your monitor and just stuff that you didn't even have a concept of. But they just sort of expected you to enter it into this configuration file that basically made no sense and turned everything on its head. It kept talking about clients and servers, and you didn't know which was which, and then displays. How do you know what your display is? Who knows? It just goes on and on. And then you had to set your mouse pointer, and there were different terminologies for that, and it had lots of different terminologies for buttons. It was just, it was a nightmare. And when they called it Bulletproof X or something like that. Where just X11 would auto-configure itself. It was a game changer. It was a completely different experience. And I think since that point on, I think Linux became a reasonable prospect for, you know, a lot more people. Whereas before that, I mean, it was near impossible to get an image on your screen without several helper applications and probably lots of forum posts. It was miserable. It was horrible. Not fun. And that was, you know, back in 2008, 2009, that time frame. So yeah, I think X11 needed to be simpler, and I don't think it ever became simple enough for its technologies to sort of earn their keep in a weird way. And I mean, as evidenced by the fact that we're not using them. We use clouds, and we use screen sharing services, and VNC, and all these other things that, you know, technically you don't need on X, and yet those are the things we're turning to, because those are easier than figuring out how X works. And that's a pity, but I mean, it's also, I think it's just kind of the way of things. I mean, X11, even by 2008 or 2009, had been around for quite a while. Things had changed, computing had changed, expectations had changed, use cases had changed. So it just didn't. Yeah, I think that I don't think that anyone betrayed anyone else. I don't think anyone failed at anything. I just think that the timeline diverged, and we're here. Something else is over there. Okay, let's talk about libx11. Guess what that is? Yes, it is the X11 protocol client library. This is the library with all the different X11 functions in it, or the basic X11 functions in it, including detecting what screen is the one that you're talking to, or painting pixels, or creating and destroying windows and things like that. This has all those functions in it. Now, whether or not you are probably talking to these functions yourself, I mean, you have to be pretty low level. Like you would be designing the frameworks that people that most other people later in the chain are using, so that they don't have to think about this. At one point, I guess people would have thought more about this, but then things like GTK and Qt came along, and then you just make calls to GTK and Qt. You don't think about how it's making what it's calling upon libx or xlib to do. You just request a certain kind of window or a certain kind of widget, and it appears in the correct place. So, I mean, obviously some people are using libx11, but I think most people are not. Most people are using the frameworks that are on top of that. Libx Screensaver is the library underpinning the X Screensaver application, if you've ever used that. I did used to use X Screensaver, but I mean, my computer's in my office at home. I don't really have a use for X Screensaver at this point. But I mean, I did used to use it to lock my screen, like at work and things like that. But X Screensaver, I mean, it's just really, really all about updating. It's really, it's every time I launch X Screensaver - settings, it warns me that the X Screensaver is too old and that I need to update it. I really ought to just remove it, to be honest. I assume we'll come across X Screensaver near the end of this. No, maybe not this directory, X directory. It'll probably be at the end of X app directory. But anyway, we'll come across X Screensaver eventually. Maybe I'll update it or something. But then I'd have to probably compile something, probably a new libx Screensaver. This is version 1.2.3, and all it contains are is libxss.so and then a bunch of man pages, which you can read if you really want to. It mostly just talks about the different functions that libx Screensaver provides you access to, all the different header files, and, you know, all the functions, like what display is the screensaver going to run on? Has the screensaver received a valid password to be dismissed, and so on. libxau is the library that provides database functions for the X authority. So if you're trying to access an X session, or I think technically, well, yeah, a next session, I guess. I don't know if it's session level or, no, it must be session level. Yeah, it would have to be session level for X Authority. So if you're trying to access some X session from afar, then you need to be authorized to do so. LibXAU provides the functions to authorize you or not, to verify your whether you are authorized. LibXAW is the Athena widget set. Right after this one is going to be the LibAW3D XFT, which is related. That's the enhanced version of the Athena widget set. So the Athena widget set is the, it's the, well, it's the widgets that you see in all of the little X applications that arguably you may not use. So for instance, XEdit, if you've ever used that, or XMan, the man page viewer written as a GUI application for arguably no good reason. These are, and what was the other one? ResEdit, I think. Resource Editor. Or was that a GUI? Am I making that up? Well, there was the one that modified widgets on dynamically as you go. So these applications are written with the Athena widget set. It is not attractive, but this was designed quite a while ago, and the idea of having sort of a GUI was, maybe novelty is maybe a little strong of a word, but I mean, it was considered a feature in itself. That was cool to have a GUI. I mean, think about, like, apparently even something like DOS didn't necessarily always have a GUI. I don't know. I never used DOS, like literally never, but I understand from people that DOS was largely a terminal or a command line based operating system, but you had like this option of having like some kind of GUI or something. So for Linux, Unix, both, which was traditionally seen as just kind of like, yeah, you're typing words and getting words back, the ability to have GUI applications was kind of cool. Athena widget set like really just made that possible, and it was included. It was part of the X11 bundle. Like, you got X11 and you got the Athena widget set. Now you could make cool little applications with buttons and widgets and things like that. Well, then along came LibAW3D XFT, and this is sort of the next step in that widget sort of design. And you can see this for yourself with XPaint, for instance. And I mean, if you do something like launch XEdit and then XPaint next to each other, you'll see pretty quickly the difference. I mean, it is really, really obvious. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that this was a 3D widget set, although maybe that's just sort of indicative of what technology it is using in order to draw the widget. So in other words, instead of painting pixels, it's probably making calls to some kind of abstraction so that it can do really, really fancy things like rearrange the widgets as you resize the window, and resize the widgets dynamically and have really, really nice little icons on the buttons rather than just blocky text. And I imagine the text here is probably adjustable. I don't see how to do that, so I'm not 100% sure that that's correct, but it does, I suspect that you could probably make it like larger or a different font if you really, really tried in XPaint. Whereas XEdit, it does appear to be mostly you see what you see is what you get. Although we know that there is XRes Edit or whatever that was called, the resource editor, where you could change things rather dynamically. So there's some ability to modify that. I just don't know that was a feature that they were worried about actually implementing at the time, because it was just so cool that you had a GUI at all. But anyway, LibAW3D XFT is the next step above XEdit. You notice it really quickly when you launch it. I mean, it's just, it looks basically like, you know, GTK1 or something. I mean, or Windows 95, maybe. You know, it's that kind of gray, blocky, but beveled edges. Like, you can see the sort of the polish behind it rather than like XEdit or XMan or whatever else, where it's just literally, it's black text on white background. It's bitmapped. You can kind of count the pixels yourself. It's just really, really rudimentary stuff. So that's kind of cool. It's kind of neat to see some progress there. And that was, again, the cool thing here is that this was just part of X11. It must have been just getting like a whole new computer. I mean, you got the graphics server, you got the GUI, you got the widgets to program with. It's just kind of phenomenal. And then the flexibility of the system, which I've already raved about, really, really progressive stuff. I legitimately think that it must have been ahead of its time. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there was other technology doing similar things at the time. Maybe this was playing catch up. Maybe it was just keeping up. I don't know. But it really does seem quite advanced. It's just, like I said, I don't know that it was easy enough for most people to truly understand. And that's a pity. But we have other things to do. We have new technology now, and that's exciting. So there you go. And we still can have X11 running in that technology. So that's great. So that's where I'll end it for now. LibXAW3D. Oh, and 3DXFT. I guess those are two technically different packages. Just now noticed that, actually. What's the 3D one? That's the enhanced thing. You should do this if you're using applications that incorporate the MIT Athena widget set and you'd like to incorporate a 3D look into those applications. Yeah, okay. So LibXAW and its 3D components. That's where we'll end it for now. And next episode, we will continue with LibXCM. Can't you just not wait to find out what the CM stands for? I sure can't, but we have to. We'll find out next time. Thanks for listening.